Welcome to Silicon Economics. Silicon Economics is a podcast where we explore the intersection of technology and economics. I'm Rob Soderbery, Executive Vice President and General Manager of the Flash Business here at Western Digital. With me is my co-host,
Adarsh Kannan, VP of Economics and Data Science here at Western Digital.
Adarsh and I are excited to bring you this episode. Let's jump in. Let's get into today's episode, where I'm thrilled to be hosting Dr. Amit Gandhi. Amit has been an early adopter in this world of chief economists of technology companies, having had senior roles at both Microsoft as well as Airbnb. And he's managed to keep his academic interests and passions alive at the same time. So welcome, Amit.
Great to be here, Rob, and thanks for the invitation.
And of course, welcome, Adarsh.
Thank you, Rob.
So let's start there. This world of economics and technology, why does a technology company need a chief economist? What does a chief economist do?
It's a little bit of job security question.
All eyes on me. Well, listen, it's I will say from the outset, it's still very new. And I mean, if you think about what a chief economist meant, I don't know, 50 years ago, I mean, I think the caricature would be a big personality, maybe a talking head, a sounding board for the CEO, maybe a media appearance on the news, and kind of really an external face. And I think what is different now, and that part still potentially exists, is really the internal aspect of how these businesses work and how they run. And so the journey is interesting, and I think the first trigger for what brought this new sort of complexion to a chief economist was just data. I mean, quite literally, companies started amassing data and asked the fundamental question, how do we extract business value from this data? So I would say like that would be maybe V1 of this journey and process where an economist can come, work with the teams, and just layer some light modeling, light interpretability, light general understanding and recognition of economic and business forces to narrate the data. So, I mean, in some ways it plays to the communication ability of the chief economist, but with some more of an internal facing kind of dynamic. I think that's even evolved further now, because if you think about data, there's lots of functions that now can grab data, machine learning and data science. And I think the chief economist role is just evolving with it. So as working with data gets more complicated, the need to understand its economic meaning and from a decision-making perspective, because fundamentally businesses are in the business of making economic decisions. And so it behooves them to invest in economics to do so. It's a challenging role because every company is different. And so fitting that thought process into a company's culture requires patience and humbleness from the economist, and that's not always the personality of the economist. And so that, you know, I think that's just been where I see the role in the area is so exciting. It's different at every company, and that's part of the joy of the job.
Yeah, it's interesting as the industry has evolved. If we wind back the clock, of course, the business that Adarsh and I are in, and semis and so on, has always been relatively capital intensive and driven by economic factors. But this advent of the as a service, whether it's the infrastructure as a service that the hyperscalers practice, or if it's the marketplace as a service that some of the places you've been involved with at Airbnb and Uber. All of a sudden that has just exploded, it seems, the applicability of really core economic thinking and understanding and assessing these businesses.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now there's an ironic twist to that, which actually is related to Adam Smith and economics at some weird level, which is if you take like a marketplace, supply, demand, forces coming together, if it's well designed from the onset, you know, one can argue markets work, right? Even without an economist.
Right.
And I find that remarkable when I look at some of the most successful marketplace companies. Look at Airbnb. It's an incredible marketplace.
Right.
There's no centralized pricing. It's laissez-faire, decentralized supply and demand dynamics. And none of the founders were economists. They were designers, they're artists, but it really goes to the heart of the market thesis that individual decisions, when organized and coordinated through the right kind of policies and parameters, can lead to globally powerful results. And so it's an interesting dynamic, because now if you know some economics and you enter a marketplace, what should you do? Because you don't necessarily want to tinker with the marketplace.
Right. Right.
And so I found that to be an interesting
free market theory.
Exactly.
Problem. I mean, can you tinker with
in
this
some ways,
and actually
maybe
prove
it's
it?
Maybe it's the easiest job. Hey,
yeah.
let the market work.
Yeah.
But you know, I think the argument I've tried to make is if you can layer some economic thinking and some economic understanding, because these systems become incredibly complicated. I mean, at some level, Uber, the business, no one person understands how the whole thing works, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you can adapt some insight into the economic forces, you can refine the product and make it that work that much better. Because even something like Airbnb, it's one big market, but you could also argue it's thousands of submarkets in these local markets. And how do you really refine it to work for the customer, for the ecosystem? That's where I think economics is pretty powerful.
Yeah, there's an overlay of being able to codify economics, which is possible now and wasn't possible in the past, right? Like we all remember times when you had to probably call somebody to book an airline ticket. Now it's all systematized, so which means you can infuse a lot of the behavioral metrics or behavioral mechanisms into the product or service itself, which was, you know, not possible a few decades ago.
Well, I mean, you bring up an interesting point, and it is sometimes the debate as to what is an economist versus, say, a data scientist. And I think you're really hitting it on the head, which is, at the end of the day, economists are trying to understand human behavior, right? Markets are human social systems. And I think it's really important that, and really valuable that the economic mindset can connect models, data, AI with behaviors that ultimately we want to understand and mold.
Well, economists these days tend to come with a deep bag of data science tricks.
That's right.
But it's not, the reverse isn't always true.
Right.
There's a lot of data engineers that may not have the business acumen to apply.
I mean, this classic economic sort of idea of comparative advantage. We all have our comparative advantages. And I think the really great companies, and not everyone has figured this out, but figure out how to keep economists working on their comparative advantage in a way that complements the data scientists, that complements sort of the computer science, and you know, working as a collective. I think there is sometimes a tendency for economists in industry to just become data scientists, because that's
right,
a well-defined career track. There's data, they learn these tools. But they lose a lot of what they've learned, and there's some really powerful ideas in what they've learned.
One of the areas that Adarsh and I spend a lot of time on is capital planning.
Yeah.
And of course, capital planning in the world of certain demand would be relatively straightforward.
Yeah.
Sadly, none of us get to play in that world. I know you've done some basic work on demand optimization and thinking about demand. And how do you approach businesses that have this need for making significant capital investments under demand uncertainty? How do you tackle problems like that?
I mean, I think you said the critical word in that whole equation, which is investment. So it's already like kind of an economic framing. I mean, sometimes companies can treat capital as a cost,
it's right.
literally a cost of capital, and that sort of changes the entire economic prism. So I think the first step is like framing the problem, right? Mm-hmm. We're making an investment problem, right? We're building an asset. And this asset will have value over time. That value may be uncertain, but can we start to just sort of understand those pieces? And part of the art of doing this, like in the case of demand uncertainty, so we have it's hard. We don't know the future, but let's just start framing the pieces of the problem, right? Like here's the markets. Here's what we think the demand looks like. Here are the things we're investing in, right? Here's how the things we're investing in lead to some product changes that touch demand, right? So just layer, I think a lot of the key to doing this well is getting those pieces of the story. once those are there, then we can start thinking about the precision, right? Because I think there's a temptation to jump into the perfect demand forecast, which
right.
doesn't exist.
Right. Right.
But even without the demand forecast, we need a demand forecast, but if we can get those pieces working, mm-hmm. then we can start to just refine and iterate, right? Let's get a starting point for demand. Now, uncertainty is interesting just because it's a very different decision-making mindset. A lot of businesses are very risk averse, as you know, and so there's a tendency to shut off the uncertainty. I have personally found that it's hard to look at like scenarios. People just want to know
right.
what's going to happen.
Right. Single point forecast. The world's going to look like three years from now.
So there is a sense, and I don't know, Adarsh, if you felt this need in your roles as the economist, sort of the demand expert, to offer opinions as to which of these scenarios you view as the most plausible. Sometimes it goes beyond the data. It goes, right. Has that been something you've
Yeah, certainly. I mean, that is something that has come to be. And even this mentality shift of saying that, look, just because I have a title as an economist doesn't mean I have an Oracle ball that I've kind of hidden away from the rest of the company. It's really about taking a disciplined or a rigorous systematic approach to stochastic demand that could change over time, and then being able to codify and say how that works backwards into our investment thesis.
That's right.
Been a lot of my role, and I'm sure we had yeah. similar journeys when Amit, you were leading yeah. some of this for large cloud providers,
yeah.
where we had to kind of get into the DNA of the organization, a mechanism to plan around the uncertainty or use the uncertainty to plan, like things like real options, as an example, mm-hmm. became a very classic way of taking economic principles and applying it in the real world,
yeah.
As opposed to just taking a view where we trivialize the thing that we find it gnarly to
yeah.
put a hands on,
that's
and
right.
basically say, hey, let's put the most possible line and plan against it, right? Again,
that's right.
been well, a huge part of the shift that Rob and I have been driving here.
Yeah, yeah, no, this idea for real option is such a beautiful, elegant economic idea. It has not seen a lot of
You may want to explain to our viewers and listeners what real option is.
Sorry,
I named
right.
Rob.
You guys are geeking out over there.
We're jumping into some serious economics. If you think about uncertainty, mm-hmm. One thing, like in financial markets, if there's uncertainty, the stock can go up, the stock can go down. One thing you can buy to manage that uncertainty is an option, right? You buy an option mm-hmm. On the claim that this asset could take off. So I have some optionalities, and that optionality has value. It has positive value, so I should pay for it. I should own it. Real options just mean that's a financial investment. Mm-hmm. Real physical assets also have optionality in the presence of uncertainty, and mm-hmm. so. In the case of a hypothetical cloud provider, if you have to build a data center and it takes 5 years to build, and I'm not sure which way the demand will go, I would like to retain some optionality. So what's a simple way to retain some optionality? What if I bought some land?
All right, build a shell.
Build a shell. And,
yeah.
you know, it just, and now the key, if you're successful as the economist, is to convince your finance organization this is not a cost. This is actually an asset that has
right.
this real asset value.
Right.
And that takes economics.
I'm purchasing an option on upside.
There you go.
In demand.
There you go. There you go.
Well, and the transformation that we've had to drive is really like 95% of corporate long range plans are done around a single view of the future. Right? This is how it happens. Pick a single view of the future for maybe 3 years, 5 years. Then you do some sort of brute force upside, downside. There'll be a war in Asia, or there'll be a super boom, and it leads to a scenario in which you're always wrong. You are always wrong, and the drift on these plans is horrific. 3-6 months after you've printed your plan, it's no longer useful.
Right.
And so, how can we kind of shift the mindset to this notion of a stochastic view of the future?
That's right.
And then in those scenarios, how does my business plan? I love to use poker analogies.
Okay. I was waiting for it.
Yeah. But, how's this hand going to play against all, all possible distributions of the cards in the deck?
Yeah. Well, I mean, business planning is an interesting problem, right? Because you form a plan and you make some decisions, and then things happen in the world, mm-hmm. and then we have to revisit the plan. Right. So it's kind of this full feedback loop that uh-huh. I think should just be built into the way planning works. It's sort of there's data. There's data that the world provides back, and the real question is like, what do you do with that data? What do you do with that mm-hmm. learning? How do you revise your plan? And recognizing, as you say, it's a thankless task because no plan will survive contact with right. the enemy, as they say. But
in our industry, one interesting aspect there is that the number of suppliers, which is the total number of people who can produce what we produce, is very limited. So we can mm. actually count them out in one hand and very few resources in the other hand. Yeah? Mm. That's the total number of players, less than half a dozen suppliers in our ecosystem overall.
I see.
So that gives us a lot of purview into how the supply side of the economics work. Mm. And we as a company tend to operate in varied markets. So we have deep understanding of the demand side of the view, where we see how much responsiveness there is in yeah. demand across the board. We see what are the feature requests, what's the willingness to pay. Like we can characterize the demand quite well.
I see.
So this has been a dream for a lot of economists in many markets, right? Like you're able to tactically characterize the supply and then tactically characterize a set of demand parameters. Of course, yeah. there's uncertainty around those parameters. Sure. But once you do that, we can write down the full game theory optimal equations in this marketplace and say, hey, there's also a supply response that I can do as a supplier, given that I know what my other competitors are going to do. Yeah. And that's been a very fruitful exercise in our ecosystem.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. I mean, if I could say one thing about just the profession and what mm-hmm. Adarsh is saying, when you take economics in school, there's really two kinds that are taught. There's what's called normative economics, which is what should we do, what decisions should get made, and then there's positive economics, which is just a description of how economies work. When we're taught, we're usually taught positive economics. Yes. That's really been the push. You know, how do these systems work?
Right.
Insofar as economists in academia think about the normative side, it's generally with a view towards policy, right? Sort of monetary
right.
policy or
right. social policy,
policy, antitrust policy, because those policies shape the way competitive dynamics unfold. Adarsh, I think what you're talking about, and this is really the unlock for the modern chief economist position, is that we can also think about normative questions at the level of the entities inside of the economy, a company, right? This is sort of a set of normative questions, and then you get into everything you just said. Well, look, if we are in this game, if we are in
right.
this this model, how does this thing play out? How does it shake out? And given that positive view, that's like a positive question, what decisions should we make? So it's a really rich interplay between those two sort of
so you see
the tagging of the positive economics has gone so much that yeah.
Right.
What was the saying? An economist is somebody who can tell you tomorrow how the weather was bad yesterday. Yeah, that's kind of, or why the weather was bad yesterday
was yeah.
probably
right.
The version that people kind of think about, but yeah. you're spot on.
Yeah.
So then you moved from the world of Microsoft Azure, yeah. which was yeah. kind of a capital intensive demand forecasting thing
yeah.
like we're talking about here, to this world of the modern marketplace.
Yeah.
Which introduces a whole new set of factors. And we sort of started to touch on that on,
yeah, yeah.
you know, do you even, you know, can you even tinker with these systems?
Right.
But what was your experience kind of going into that marketplace world? Yeah. What did that look and feel like?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say from a professional career development perspective, what was important to me is to sort of see what would it look like if economics was a little bit more core to the product, which is to say, the product is economics. Like if it's a marketplace, right. then the product is quite literally economics. So in that sense, I did find, like if you take a hardware company or a cloud company, you know, the technology and software is still reign supreme, right? And then we kind of want to layer some economic thinking to sort of make it work in practice. I think marketplace companies are actually the reverse, which is to say, I don't want to knock any of the technologies there, but you know, the technology doesn't have to be great or perfect
right.
or amazing. But the economic principles have to be right, right? It's one of those things where you can't get the economics wrong. So I think it provides economists more of an opportunity to really get it, to go from planning, which is where my world was, and just thinking long-term, bigger picture investments, into products, features, down to individual decisions. Should we launch A versus launch B? So in that sense, it's I think, a really interesting path. But as I mentioned before, when do you want to exercise that rich understanding of the marketplace versus when do you just want to sort of let it let it work? I mean, one scenario that I found fascinating, I'll just say at Airbnb or any kind of two-sided marketplace, here's a classic issue. You have two sides. I have like supply and I have demand. Mm-hmm. So if I make a product change that increases demand, a search feature,
right?
Great, but what if that product change increases demand, but now it hurts a subset of suppliers? Mm. Right? Maybe it makes their earnings very volatile.
Right.
Right. How do you even think about that trade-off? Like that is a very profound question that literally demand and supply are not aligned in terms of where this product feature is. What this product feature is doing. So I really, to me, that's sort of, it opens up that new class of question that I think is just pretty exciting from that.
Yeah, this aspect of mechanism design of the marketplace or like the way you sort of set it up has played out in several places, right? Like one example that comes to me starkly is eBay versus Amazon. Yeah. Both where, at least in the Amazon, the seller business, right? The one where Amazon does not buy the inventory and they don't take any inventory risk. Both the marketplaces were meant to connect a seller and a buyer.
Yeah.
eBay came up with the thesis that you have this auction place, you'd come, you'd participate in the auction, there's no certainty that you're getting the product at a particular price. It was a buyout feature, but they had it pretty late. So from the buyer experience, the behavioral aspect was pretty painful in one sense, right? Like, 'cause you had to come in, you had to kind of see the auction, you don't know if you're gonna win the auction and what have you. And then Amazon came about and they had the marketplace design where it's a third party seller could be selling on Amazon. You buy for a fixed price and then Amazon as a marketplace does the vetting for you because they would make sure that good sellers end up showing a lot more higher in your ranking or like have a higher probability of fetching a sale. And they baked in the behavioral metrics that they want to see from a good seller and codified it into the platform, right? Like, so if you are if you are able to maintain inventory, I've tried selling books, old books on Amazon. As long as you can meet the orders at the frequency that you're getting and you're able to ship them on USPS and whatnot, you keep getting your orders back again. Yeah. The moment you slip that top tier seller ranks, you kind of go down, right? Actually a notion or a place where I would say taking the technology challenge, which is cataloging and making sure that the products are all unified in the same place, and then bringing it with the economics of it, which is improving the buying experience, has even bigger bang for the buck, right? Like this is a little bit of a pushback, Amit, on the idea you were saying about, you know, like how it's more of the mechanism design and it's like the two forces can actually combine together.
That's right.
To have a bigger
That's
bang.
Right. That's right. And to be clear, platforms, marketplaces do impact the functionality, right? They're not agnostic. They can't be neutral. No matter how hard you try,
right?
You are impacting the way this works. I think the spectrum is how, and what is the strength of a platform is the fact that because it's the intermediary, that's where all the data lives. It does really go back to data. So if the data is there in terms of what consumers want, who's a good supplier, what matches should get made, the real question is how much to exercise that muscle, right? And do you give it back to the participants?
Right.
Here's data, here's insight, or do you then take it into your own hands and say, no, look, I'm just going to decide which are my best sellers and I'm going to steer them to my most valuable customers.
Well, and this, you know, the core of all these platforms, that trust and safety is just the absolute core value prop. But then it seems like a question of, well, how much trust and safety is enough? How much do I get paid for that trust and safety? Is trust and safety itself, is that the is that the thing I'm selling, right?
Yeah.
Versus how well I present you know, the options or all the other features and bells and whistles that go on both sides of that platform.
That's right. And even trust is a great economics problem, because at some level, every market transaction involves a degree of trust. Because, and the economic principle here is we can never write a perfect contract. There's all these contingencies that could emerge. So like trust is sometimes seen as like what they call like the oil of the economic machine, right? So if you can understand those principles, what allows trust in the real world, you know, companies, you know, can and do try to build them into the platform. So I think it's pretty fascinating.
Rob was spot on there, I would say, because like when the Web3 side of the world came, everyone was talking about some of these platform businesses and multi-sided marketplaces getting disrupted, because at the end of the day, it's a supply-demand matching problem. So if you could democratize holding of wallets and capabilities within the phone, great. Then you almost solved this problem.
Not really a bastion of trust.
Yeah. But that's exactly the point that I was going to, which is, you know, somehow the ecosystem players, like just having that marketplace and that safety icon, even if I'm not exercising it, knowing that there is a big entity backing this, either in the form of insurance, say in Airbnb's case, it could be host insurance, for Uber, just knowing that I can press a button so that there's a quick way to contact somebody, gets me to be safely sitting in a stranger's car.
That's right.
That's another place where, you know, truly these marketplaces have taken a behavioral metric, which is user's trust. And to an alien, you know, both are the same, right? You go sit in a stranger's car, one way or the other. For humans, it's not.
But still goes back to the fundamental question, how much of it is trust the marketplace, trust us, the platform, or trust the participants on the other side? And I think one thing the platforms can do that I've encouraged is to recognize, look, if you can trust the other side of this transaction, that's a much more scalable dynamic,
right?
So what we really want to get in the business of doing is sort of instilling, you know, building tools and instilling norms, if you will, that sort of allow trust at scale. You know, trust at scale is hard. It's hard to do. I think it's also interesting because it doesn't sound economic, but it's deeply economic, right? That's how any economic system works. So I've worked on a few sort of trust problems. I think the other value prop of economics, like if you take something like trust, it's very easy for us to just start using our intuitive sense of what trust means. A lot of the value of economics, even in a trust question, is just defining terms. What does trust mean, right? Like how can we write down some principles? I think that's so important to that kind of a conversation. It's really hard to make progress on trust until we have defined trust. I do think that that's a really valuable aspect of what economics brings.
Yeah, and I think if you look around the messy bits of the of these platforms, clearly Amazon Marketplace has a lot of messiness in terms of particularly supplier side of these platforms, as well as, you know, this whole returns issue on the buyer side. So that's a platform's actually tolerated quite a bit of, let's say, noise in the system.
Yeah.
You know, Airbnb has dealt with that in different ways. Uber has dealt with that different ways. But just that, where do you set that knob?
Yeah.
And how much, sort of free market chaos I'm willing to tolerate in my trust system.
That's right.
There's a value for trust, right? Like, and economists are classically trained to do weird experiments like this, where we could probably put a label that says, you know, Food and Drug Administration, approved, right? Like, versus not having the label and then see at what price point that do customers flip between the two, or how much of the sale conversion happens. So it's like a classic way of sort of taking these nebulous human behavioral metrics and associating it to this one metric that we all can measure, which is value or money.
That's right.
That's like in the wheelhouse of an economist's training.
That's right. That's right. Now, with something like trust, it's interesting because what could allow us to design for trust is if people are fundamentally trustworthy, right? I think what economics can't do is necessarily completely change human nature.
That's right.
So part of what economics can do is, let's say trust is the minority, distrust is the minority. It's only 5% of bad actors, right? We know from economics, adverse selection, you know, the bad money can crowd out the good money, right? Then that's a market failure, Okay, right. Now we know how to think about that. What's the information, ratings, badging? Right. But if it's the case that 80% of potential hosts are just bad human beings, then that's a hard problem to overcome.
Well, that was the seminal moment of the marketplace evolution, is when somebody had the realization that actually 95, 98, 99% of these people are not bad actors.
That's right.
And be able to make that initial leap.
Yeah.
Obviously, that was not something that was widely held. And the economic returns flew to the people that figured that out first.
Yeah. And you start thinking about the economics is really rich here. So if you take a new platform that has some trust and, mm-hmm. and safety, maybe question marks associated to it, who are the earliest adopters? Well, the people who are maybe most willing to take risk, right? Most willing to accept that reality. And really just the whole adoption curve.
Right.
You start to layer that against
so economic experiment preferences. All to itself.
Yeah, and just understanding, well, if we grew this far through one kind of risk profile, mm-hmm. but to get to that next rung, mm-hmm. we're going to have to design differently. It's a different economic decision that next segment of the market is making. And so I think that's a good kind of hard question.
And it's kind of interesting here because paradoxically, economists are trained to think about homo economicus, right? The rational agent was there to get you in every opportunity possible.
Yeah.
And then, anthropologists have really got a win here because, they've time and immemorial been saying things around human beings are inherently trustworthy. There's a group dynamic, mm-hmm. but there's a very mm-hmm. small portion of the population that's not trustworthy.
That's right.
And then we've now witnessed a lot more marketplaces that are successful.
That's right.
Building on this, the anthropologist's version of the world.
That's
and
right.
And the economist's version of the world. Although we do have things like auction systems, which are pure mm-hmm. rational agent mm-hmm. Proofed systems. There's just straight up incentive compatibility there, mm-hmm. like in the game theory.
Amit,
do you want to define incentive compatibility for our viewers and listeners?
It's a very powerful idea. I mean, incentive compatibility is if you build a system expecting a certain outcome, let's say you're going to build a system that gets people to bid in a way that they want to bid what they truly think it's worth to mm-hmm. them, right? You want to make sure you've built your system in a way that they don't want to game the system, right? If you're trying to game the system,
right,
then that's no longer incentive compatible,
right?
So you the incentives
get an optimal outcome,
and so finding a way to align the incentives of the actors with the goal you're trying to achieve is this problem of incentive compatibility. It's one thing to do it in theory, at Audarsha, as you know. It's another thing to do it in practice. But I think this is also goes to the heart of, I think, the value of the chief economist position, to bring it back to your mm-hmm. first question. It's recognizing that's even a relevant consideration.
Right.
Like, we need to think about incentive compatibility.
Right.
Who would have known, right?
Right.
I mean, unless there was an economist in the room.
Right.
Would that issue have even
or a visionary
fun? Or a visionary EVP such as yourself? But no, so I think a lot of it, the value is it's language. It's knowing what's the right language to inject in the right business conversation. And once you figure out the language, you can leverage all this great thinking that already exists.
Yeah, I'm also interested in your thoughts on pricing. You've seen a couple of these large platforms that have very different approaches to pricing, really dictated by the structure of their underlying markets. I mean, it makes sense why rideshare would have a different pricing mechanism than the short-term rental market. But, how do you see that notion of marketplace pricing evolve? Are we at a steady state position here, or is there room in these systems to continue to evolve the pricing mechanics?
Oh, I think there's a lot of room. I mean, pricing is still very basic, if you think about it, that we have every aspect of the experience could be priced, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, pricing can be incredibly rich. The richer we make it, the more we tie to the value it provides to the customer, the end user. At the same time, the more complicated we make it, the less usable is the pricing system. So it's really this trade-off between value creation and complexity. Sticking to low complex, there's a single price, and mm-hmm. Someone has to figure it out, whether it's the supplier or the platform. Even for any business, I mean, pricing is still the highest point of leverage you have on everything you do, right? A 1% change in price can have disproportionate impact on your bottom line. And so it's funny to me that not a lot of whether you're in a marketplace or a standard business, we sort of just accept there's some pricing and we adopt it.
Right.
And you know, versus recognizing, man, if you just kind of can sort of break out what is an optimal price, there's incredible upside business value in it. I think pricing is hard because it's frightening to change price. If you make the price high, you lose demand. If you make the price low, you cannibalize profits. And so it's just a hard variable to change. And in platforms, sometimes it's easy just to let the system figure it out, right? Because you're not bearing as much responsibility. But I do think we're moving more in the direction where the set of pricing instruments is becoming richer, right? So we can price more components. We can start thinking about subscriptions. We can think about insurance. We can think about bundles. And now, you know, our product is just getting richer. And that, I think, is really a first order question for not just platforms, but just any business. I mean, the dream here is every customer, if you read a book, gets an individual price.
Right. That reflects their preferences.
That reflects their preferences, right? That's first best. I should price for everyone differently. Lots of constraints that prevent us from getting there. But that's kind of the core idea, is that we should price for the person.
Well, and you know, we play in a market and technology that still has that legacy of the enterprise sales rep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the enterprise sales rep having a value conversation and having a share of wallet conversation and fundamentally a human powered like pricing approach. And of course, this is how, you know, advertising got sold back in the day. Mm-hmm. And then you saw this wholesale transformation from human-powered pricing to a marketplace.
Yeah.
And it's curious to say, well, what are the big opportunities out there where you're going to see pricing convert from, you know, from these old school, people-driven approaches.
Right.
And that's the scary bit, right?
Yeah.
Is the market truly efficient, and do I get a truly better global outcome by moving to an exposed, transparent, pricing system?
Right. And what are the fundamentals behind those deals, right? If you're cutting a deal between enterprise sales agent A and you know, customer supplier B, obviously both sides have interests. There's asymmetric information, so you know, one side is information that they're not sharing with the other side. They're trying to find, it's like a bargaining problem. You're trying to find a middle ground. I do think it's interesting. This is also where, having some data that, you know, provide a sense of, like, basically here are the boundaries. Like, here's the space in which prices could live, right?
Right.
So think about just like, start with some structure, right? Here's some basic structure. Now within that structure, have your deal, you know, make your conversation. So I do think it's a case in point where we don't want to lose enterprise sales. We need enterprise sales, right? You have to get out there, and you have to talk to the customer. You got to engage. But can we empower that function to just have some more economic insight into what they're doing?
Right, and there's a long-term trade-off that the human beings may inherently make, right? Like, because the enterprise rep has to go sit down with the customer the next quarter, and the quarter after that, and the quarter after that.
That's right.
So this is all. There's also how much you can sort of capture long-term signals versus how transactional your market is, like. Yeah. Search auctions are a classic transactional market. You lose the keyword, you're not worried, you're going to go back in and bid again. You have your valuation and you're kind of repeating that game. But in a transactional, in a non-transactional enterprise sale market, it's quite difficult. And some of the unbundling and the prices that we see have maybe even annoyed us as consumers, right? Like I go to an airline today, between like the row that is on the wing versus the one that you get behind, there's a difference in price. You want to carry on an extra item, then you have a difference in price. The unbundling has maybe swung a little bit too far for the experience as well.
That's right.
But I guess airlines are, you know, purely commodified at this point in time, at least in a large market like the US. where you have enough number of flyers between cities.
That's right.
And so that trade-off still may require some sort of a humanness and a decision support system, as you call it, Amit, where they make this long-term trade-off with the customer as opposed to just making the customer feel bad, right?
Like that's because
of the short-term pricing gains.
That's right. Yeah, so pricing is part of the customer experience, right? And
whether
it's the enterprise experience or consumer experience. One thing I will say about enterprise businesses, now having been on the enterprise side and the consumer side, in some ways the enterprise problem is harder. What do consumer businesses do really to figure out prices? If we don't know anything else, what can we do? Run an experiment.
Right. Wiggle
set, price A, price B, which gave us more profit? That's just not available in an enterprise environment. And so it does take a little bit more principle to unpack how to think about optimality. That being said, I think consumer businesses can swing too far in the realm of just, and Amazon has had lots of problems with this. And why have people historically gone to Amazon and seen two different prices? They're behind an experiment. And so I think there's good in both, but the enterprise problem is potentially harder and just different.
So I mean, like one question there that's always been nagging me is, how do you think about it in a perishable inventory market, right? Something like Airbnb, there you're also competing against owned and operated providers. So if you don't sell your inventory, are you better off selling your hotel room at a marginal rate that you can make back your staff and electricity and whatnot?
Yeah.
Or are you better off not selling it, right? Like, and that becomes a very difficult conversation to have. It's different in an own and operate setup. It's very different in a host setup.
Especially when you have heterogeneous inventory, right? Every item is different. Every home is different. We're talking about the chief economist function. Even the idea of introducing an inventory, perishable inventory sort of mindset to that problem, I mean, that's still advanced by industry standards. I mean, if you think about airlines, we're talking about airlines, they were some of the most sophisticated to first figure this out, right? I have X seats.
Right.
They're going to fill over time, and I'm going to have a yield curve that just changes. And so I'm going to have prices that are dynamic pricing.
Right.
It took a lot of, but it's an easier problem. Every seat's up to
more or less the same, right?
Up to maybe a few location issues are roughly the same, and the timing of who shows up is somewhat predictable. Business travelers, leisure travelers. You take it to a platform that has different homes. Really hard to just apply that. So I don't doubt you, but that's probably not even the first problem. The first problem is still, if I reduce price, I'm going to make more or less money.
right.
If I could feel comfortable with that, then I can. So we can start thinking about, okay, what is the optimal portfolio of inventory to hold in a given point in time? And that it's really, I'm going back to option value. It is having a more dynamic view of the problem, and that is also still very hard. Most businesses are still incredibly myopic. Right? We have 3-month. You're doing at least long term planning, but most people have these 3-month. Horizons over which they're optimizing, and real economics is always going to teach us to have a longer purview, and that's hard.
Now, you've stayed active in the academic world.
Yeah.
Are we going to see some more academic research from you, or what's the future hold?
The dream has always been, take this collected learnings from multiple companies, and still really interested in working, especially with marketplace companies. I'm forming the opinion, and this is part of some sort of book research I'm putting together, just on, they're more similar than they are dissimilar, has been a point of view that I've been forming, or wishes to say, apart from slapping on homes versus cars versus games, the canonical questions are the same, right? And if we can kind of just sort of have a playbook, you're a marketplace, here's really what you got to know and what you got to tackle from an economics perspective. That's from a, let's call it pedagogical perspective, something that has interested me. I think from a research point of view, there's still so much we don't know. I think doing research, it's what's challenging for the academics working on these questions is that they're looking at it from quite afar, right? They haven't spent time inside of the companies to recognize it's not just ideas. It's,
right.
It's practical implementation.
It's individual actions. It's thousands it's right. or tens of thousands of people.
Exactly. And yeah. so one of the things I have found interesting, especially coming back to a business school, I'm at the Wharton School of Business, is an appetite to kind of show how this is done, right? How do you go from, I have a theory that almost every paper you read in an academic journal has billions of dollars of business value. They're all great ideas. They're right. incredible ideas. They're such as you could think about it as universities to companies should be seen as your R&D workbench. Like, you know, this is like 15, 20 years of deep, heavy research. What's really hard is just the last mile problem. Like, how do you pick up any one of these and sort of implement it?
Right.
And that, I feel, is just a skill. It's just it's a new craft. It's a new feel. This is another part of what the chief economist does. And so, you know, part of my research, to an extent now, is laying out some of these practical barriers.
I think that's a great way to think about that chief economist role, which is it is that last mile of how do I take these intellectual frameworks and these mechanical frameworks and actually apply them into real world scenarios.
Yeah,
it's really
the
only way.
Yeah,
that can get done.
Yeah, I mean, the great irony of my whole path in this space, my core research, if you just looked at it on paper, you would think every company in the world is using my research. I literally talk about the demand and supply of what are called differentiated products. That's all these companies. Mm-hmm. Not once, and this is still a deep embarrassment to me, have I ever used my own research? I'm glad he's used my own research. But it just goes to show, like, when you write about it in the abstract, you miss something. You miss something. And so I do want to eventually find, I'll have to ask Adarsh how he did it, to draw that bridge a little bit more between my research and
I think there's a theoretical construct as well that is of, interest in the popular world, which is this issue of monopolism, pricing, and we go back to our conversation about trust.
Yeah.
So we now know that what we're paying Uber for, Airbnb or StubHub is trust. Mm-hmm. Now the question is, as these platforms become more dominant in the market, is that spread reflective of the value of trust?
That's right.
Or is that spread now somehow become reflective of the power of that marketplace? And Ticketmaster being the poster child for this one, because so many people are exposed to the fee structure there.
That's right.
But in essence, it's the same argument as in the Uber, you know, spread between drivers and passengers and so on. So it seems like an academic understanding of pricing and its role on that conversation is would be a super interesting area.
100%. And Ticketmaster particularly is like one of those places where the ecosystem wasn't contained just to the marketplace. They started striking deals with venues. They were able to make exclusive venues, exclusive artists, and they sort of grew from there. So there's a clear path to understand the network effects and externalities of these marketplaces how they kind of grow beyond what was originally just their surface area to
the broader economy. That's right. The network effects, what Arash is saying is the more people who use it, the more valuable it becomes. And that becomes like a runaway form of market power, kind of as you're suggesting. That said, I mean, even if you take Ubers or Airbnbs, you can stay at hotels and you can still
get
a cabin. What is the if we had to use the words sort of the monopolistic power, I think is still debatable.
I think that's what makes it interesting. Arguably you've got a direct competitor, you have direct alternatives, you've got taxis, you've got public transportation.
Right. And even going back to just pricing even a little. Mm-hmm. StubHub rather famously experimented with the idea of, so customers don't always know what price they're paying, right? Mm-hmm. So when you just look at the price, there are two kinds of prices, right? There's an upfront price where every fee is baked into the single price the customer sees, or there is kind of component pricing. I sort of show you different components, and not just different components at different points in your search flow.
Right.
So I see a price in here versus a price B, sometimes known as drip pricing. But you know, that alone has
right.
significant impact on what customers believe is the price they're paying to the value prop of,
right.
Of the platform versus just the price of the service.
I think we're getting into episode two.
Okay. We'll save that one.
That's
a big topic.
Particularly in travel. Well, look, it's been a wonderful conversation.
Yeah.
Love to dive into all these aspects of the technology and economics realm you've seen. And we really look forward to seeing what's going to come from you in the future.
Yeah, well, I'd love to come back and want to mm-hmm. commend you on hiring such an excellent chief economist yourself. Adarsh is incredibly skilled. I've learned a lot from him, and I look forward to seeing what ideas you put out into the public sphere on this very same topic.
Well, I'm only humbled to do that. Thank you.
All right, and with that, we'll wrap up another episode of Silicon Economics. Thank you for joining us for today's episode. If you enjoyed it, like, share, and subscribe. And we're always looking forward to hearing your feedback. And be on the lookout for the next episode of Silicon Economics.